Music.
Now looking to the sky to save me, looking for a sign of life. I'm saying we are so excited. I mean, you guys are really going to rock the whole wide world. We welcome you back with a huge parade.
Just posting a story.
I'm just changing the song.
I'm just...
No. When it comes to distracted driving, just don't. Sending a text takes your eyes off the road for just 5 seconds, but in that time, your car can travel the length of an entire football field. Any distracted driving just isn't worth it.
Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Oh,
RCT. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, CNBC brought viewers the news that Cuba has suspended its annual cigar festival. The postponement, if you wondered, quote, comes as the island nation's communist-run government endures its biggest test since the collapse of the Soviet Union, close quote. Assured that you've heard both communist and Soviet Union, the biggest test bit has a link to another CNBC article, same writer, headlined, What's Next for Cuba? Trump Turns the Screws as the Island Runs Out of Jet Fuel. Now, take a breath. Why does Donald Trump get to punish Cuban people? Why is it cute to talk about turning the screws? Can other countries turn the screws on the United States if they don't like the U.S. and its capitalist-run government? And above all, when did illegal actions carried out with the express intent of causing misery for other human beings become blah, blah, blah? The Trump White House is openly trying to harm the Cuban people, and U.S. news media are openly trying to sell that to us as something to root for. Reed Lindsay has been reporting and making documentary film in and about Cuba for more than a decade. We'll hear from him on what you might not be hearing from corporate media. That's coming up, but first a quick look back at some recent press. Reverend Jesse Jackson passed away on February 17th. From Wikipedia, you can learn that he was a civil rights activist, politician, ordained Baptist minister, and a protege of Martin Luther King Jr. Jackson's work and legacy taught us a lot, not least about the limits and biases of mainstream news media. More could and will be said, but right now we can note the way corporate reporters weaponized themselves against Jackson's work and particularly his presidential candidacies. The Wall Street Journal described Jackson's speeches as rants. NPR compared him to a fortune cookie, which, quote, you get whether you want it or not, close quote. A Washington Post columnist described him as the monster from the Black Lagoon. Jackson's policies were widely dismissed by journalists as far left or even far out. Addressing the American Society of Newspaper Editors in April of 1988, Ronald Reagan asserted that criticism of Jackson had been muted out of concern that, quote, it might be misinterpreted into some kind of racial attack, close quote. This was meant to underscore the then popular media notion that somehow Jackson had got a free ride with the press, who apparently were confused and misled by the information that polls were giving him twice the support of his nearest Democratic rivals. And he was running strong in many states, including overwhelmingly white ones. So then we got a phase of, what does Jesse want? That was a Newsweek cover story that conveyed the premise that white candidates are aspiring to be president because they want to be president, but black candidates must have ulterior motives because, you know, cough, cough, that only skilled reporters can unmask. Those would include wanting influence over cabinet choices or other important decisions that white people were supposed to make. Jackson's support among white working class people confounded mainstream journalists who worked overtime to say that it was just an irrational response to his spellbinding rhetoric. Tributes are now, as USA Today says, pouring in for civil rights icon Jesse Jackson. I know for true that Jackson would encourage us to not rest or wait on those tributes to tell us where to walk. As his family said in a statement, we ask you to honor his memory by continuing the fight for the values he lived by. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Cuba is in a humanitarian crisis that is growing worse by the day, with major blackouts and fuel and food priced out of reach due to the U.S.-imposed oil blockade and the illegal U.S. interference in the government of longtime oil supplier Venezuela. The latest headlines here describe garbage piling up in the street with the potential for spreading disease as garbage trucks lack the fuel to function. Trump's Cuba policy is run by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who's been overt in his calls for regime change in Cuba, an oddly passive term used to describe the effort of one country to unilaterally depose the government of another sovereign country and impose one deemed more favorable. And hey, a good way to do that is to use any means available to make the people of that country so miserable that they themselves bring about or welcome the change. That sounds dramatic because it is, but Cuba has been under economic embargo since before many Counterspin listeners were alive. And U.S. news media coverage still reflects a framing that hasn't shifted much in that time. Journalist, filmmaker Reed Lindsay has been reporting on Cuba and making documentaries about the country for more than a decade. He works with the project Belly of the Beast and writes for outlets including Jacobin and Counterpunch. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Reed Lindsay.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Jean.
Well, Trump said a couple days ago, we're talking to Cuba right now, and Marco Rubio is talking to Cuba right now, and they should absolutely make a deal because it's really a humanitarian threat. Now, CNN called that strong-arming, but in the same sentence, they said that it was an effort to achieve reforms in Cuba. So, at the most basic level of language, the story is muddled. How does one country strong arm another country into reform? And then again, at a fundamental level, a blockade, a belligerent act designed to cut off trade and supplies, isn't that an act of war? And is the U.S. at war with Cuba?
The U.S. is at war with Cuba and has been for a while. When we started Belly of the Beast, 6 years ago, we started it just as Trump had rolled back the opening that was happening under Obama, and he was intensifying sanctions, and we were trying to report on that, and we did a documentary series, and we were trying to come up with a name for it, and we ended up landing on the war on Cuba, because in looking into U.S. policy and economic sanctions and looking at the actual definition of what it is the U.S. is doing to Cuba, it is indisputably economic warfare. And it's not a term that major media outlets ever use. In fact, when we started using it, some people would say, well, I don't know, that's pretty strong language. I'm not sure if you should say that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we say, well, look it up. Mm-hmm. Look it up in Encyclopedia Britannica. Look up the definition of what economic warfare is. It is the sanctions. The embargo, the blockade, depending on how you call it, you can use a lot of different words, but in the end, what it is economic warfare. And it's been around since the early 60s. There's a quote that we often point to from a Lester Mallory, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs in 1960, when he was making an argument to impose embargo. The embargo hadn't fully been imposed yet. And he said that what we need to do essentially is to sabotage Cuba's economy, to decrease monetary and real wages, deny money and supplies to Cuba, bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow of government. And we have to do that as adroitly and inconspicuously as possible. Mm-hmm. That was the argument made at that time. And that's basically been the playbook since then. The objective is to make people in Cuba suffer to such a degree, and to do it in such a sort of discreet way where you're blaming the Cuban government for all the problems, the people will eventually rise up and overthrow the government. That's still the playbook. The only difference now is the economic warfare is more intense than ever.
Right, right. And well, people can see that if they choose. They can see the images of people, of garbage piled in the street, of trucks that can't run. They can read accounts of people who are saying, we are in fact being made miserable. And so it would seem the simplest thing in the world to say, as the headline of your piece with Amba Gurgerian for Jacobin, Washington's war on Cuba is collective punishment. That seems like a simple thing to say. And yet, if we fully took that on board, it would have to change the conversation. I mean, collective punishment is prohibited under these Geneva Conventions that we claim to care about, right?
Yeah. You know,
or some claim to care about.
Right. One line you see a lot. I mean, it's boilerplate in mainstream media coverage. Pretty much any New York Times article you'll see on Cuba. You'll see a line in there that says, you know, Cuba's economy is in crisis as a result of Cuban government's economic mismanagement of the economy and the embargo, right? So they're covering their bases there. And it's just, you can copy and paste that, and you'll find it in almost every article that you see on Cuba. And that sort of muddles things. That makes it not so clear. Well, what is the problem? Of course, you know, Cuba has this communist system. The economy doesn't really work. They're mismanaging. They're corrupt. And so, obviously, the Cuban government, are they brilliant in managing the economy? No, right? Yeah. Or do they commit errors all the time? Surely, like every other government in the world. But by doing this, the end result is you're sort of downplaying the impact of the most powerful country in the world proactively trying to destroy the economy of a country of 10 million people 90 miles away from the shores. The impact, you can't measure it. Nobody really knows the impact of the blockade. But it's real, and I've seen it with my own eyes. People in Cuba have as well. And you can see it just in the last 10 years. 10 years ago, during the opening with Obama, it's night and day compared to how it is right now. Mm-hmm. And so what's the difference? Well, 10 years ago, Cuba had the same communist government. They had the same economic system.
Right.
Like, was the economy booming? No. But the problem, the severe problems that are happening now in terms of scarcities of fuel, scarcities of medicine, like the degree of suffering that is occurring now is not what was happening 10 years ago. And what is the factor that has changed? It is the intensification of sanctions. It is the ramping up of the economic warfare. Cuban government's the same. In fact, speaking of reform, and this is another thing that's not really well reported, the Cuban government has been reforming in recent years. In fact, they passed a new constitution recently that allowed for private companies to be formed, and many have been formed. In fact, if there wasn't this economic warfare, the private sector would be booming. So it's sort of like this elephant in the room, the embargo, the economic warfare that's going on from the U.S., and it's acknowledged. You can't completely ignore it, but it's sort of mentioned in passing in most of the major media coverage of Cuba, and then they move on to other issues.
And I would just add to that the way that the New York Times and other outlets do it. You say, you know, they'll say they're talking about suffering and hardships, and they'll say it's due to there being communists who mismanage their economy and the embargo. Another thing that they will do is to say the Cuban government or Cuban people blame the U.S. embargo for their hardships. They put that little, you know, kind of caveat in there to where it's the U.S. embargo is mentioned as something that Cubans blame for their hardships, you know, so it even adds that other degree of distance.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. They attribute it all the time. Usually attribute it to the Cuban government.
Right.
As if, like, well, we're not really sure. It may mean isn't really having an impact. The Cuban government says it isn't. Okay, now let's move on.
And we can't trust them anyway, right? You know, what we know is that we can't trust them. Well, I have to say it is quite a feat to say that Cuba is a failed country that can't get itself together. And it is also simultaneously, in Trump's words, an unusual and extraordinary threat to the United States. So this is by way of justifying the executive order threatening tariffs on any country that sells oil to Cuba. So how do you push the line? How do you make a narrative that says this failed country is an extraordinary threat to the United States?
Yeah, it's funny because we're actually working on a video right now, which is coming out soon, in which the journalist on our team makes that very point. She says, so you're saying this country, which has the oldest population in the Americas, which is going through this horrific economic crisis, poses a national security threat to the United States, really? You know, they also said that Cuba was propping up Venezuela. Imagine, you have an oil-producing country, Venezuela, much larger than Cuba, and Cuba somehow, which is going through this devastating economic crisis where they can't keep the lights on, is propping up Venezuela. That's another, which again, you see repeated again and again in major league outlets. But what one thing, you know, in this executive order, they laid out the justification for this measure. And the justification was that it's a malign influence in the hemisphere and it's a national security threat. And they specified how it's a national security threat. They said, well, the biggest Russian spy base in the hemisphere is in Cuba. And they said that Hamas and Hezbollah were in Cuba.
Okay.
There's no evidence of this. And we've done extensive reporting. It's sort of ridiculous because we actually have gone out to report on these types of accusations. And you sort of feel like you know it's false.
Right.
It's just patently false. And it's hard to disprove something. You could say there are aliens in Cuba as well.
I was going to say, it's cartoonish. It's cartoonish, you know, it seems to me. Like Hamas, Hezbollah, who else can you name, you know? And yet this is being put forward seriously and is being evidently taken seriously, at least, you know, as a background by reporters, by our First Amendment protected press corps.
Yeah, well, you know, there was a Russian spy base. It's been like 25 years. It was there during the Cold War,
right?
Unsurprisingly. Soviet Union had a spy base. It eventually was shut down. For the last 25 years, they've been talking about Rubio himself. And he did, in the debate with Trump, in the primary debate with Trump in 2016, this came up in Miami. And I think it was a CNN debate where Rubio said, you know, there's this China spy base in Cuba. We've got to get rid of it. And that's been, Rubio's been talking the China spy base, and so on. And we've reported on it. We report on the fact that there's no evidence that there's a China spy base.
Well, I got to pause you there because we went from Russia to China, and I know that the line does that too, but there was a Russian spy base, and now there are accusations of a China spy base. Whose spy base? What's the reality there?
Well, now it's back. It's apparently back to Russia.
Okay.
You know, it's funny, though. We actually, when we were looking for the spy base, we Googled, right? We looked on Google. You can see it on the map. Of course, you go there and you talk to people, and they say, well, there's no Russians here, no Chinese here, and there's no evidence of the spy base, right? So,
well, you've kind of gone over a lot of it. I know that you've been observing U.S. media on Cuba for a long time, and there are people who are just kind of learning this history and this politics now, and I think will be surprised at how dusty it is, you know, how Cold War framed it is, you know. And yet, we do have outlets. We do have people who are doing independent reporting. There are other places that people can look if they want to move outside the kind of rigid and cartoony presentation in so-called mainstream news, right? There are other places that people can look for up-to-date information about Cuba.
Yeah. And I also feel like in the United States, despite all of this fake news and misinformation, people really want to go to Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
You saw that during Obama. I mean, people were going in droves. And even now, people go, despite the fears and the lies about Cuba, people go. And one thing I've noticed, when they go from the United States, everyone, they can't believe it. I have not run into a single person in the United States who's visited Cuba and hasn't said, wow, this is not at all what I thought it was going to be like.
Right.
Even though, and these are people who are open to Cuba, right? These are people who are willing to you know, get on a plane and go to a place that a lot of people say you shouldn't go to. And even they were like, wow, this is not at all what I've been reading about and hearing about in media.
I think a lot of Americans are shocked when they learn also that people in other places in the world don't think Cuba is a pariah, you know, where the living envy the dead. And then one example that I know you've written about also, when Cuba did during COVID, as they've done on a number of occasions, send doctors around the world, Belen Fernandez wrote for fair.org about how media were saying, oh, yeah, that's cool that they're doing that, but, and this is Bloomberg, quote, allowing Havana to exploit the virus for hard currency will just empower repression at home, close quote. So even when Cuba is presented, as it often is in international media, as doing something obviously overtly positive, there still has to be a little note that says, but don't think it's good. Don't think it's good because it's still Cuba. It's so simplistic and stupid. Yeah. And it's amazing that media think people will continue to fall for it forever.
Yeah. Yeah. An example of that, I reported for a while in Haiti, and the Cuban medical mission there was incredible. I was blown away because the aid program, as many people know, in Haiti, from the U.S. and Europe and so on, have been a total disaster.
Right.
And with not only no positive impact to show for all the money they spend, but in many cases, the destructive impact. Yeah. And the Cuban medical mission, quietly in Haiti, amazing public healthcare system. It saved so many lives, changed so many lives. I was reporting in Haiti for 5 years. I never saw a single major media outlet cover that. And the Cubans have missions all over the world. And not only have I not seen any positive coverage of these missions, but it's all negative. Yeah. It's all negative. Well, Cuba's only doing this for these, you know, the nefarious reasons. One is they make money. Well, they're not making money in Haiti. Right. So what's the reason there? The reason given in Haiti, when it's ever even mentioned at all, is that it's basically PR. They're trying to look good. Okay, well, that might make sense if the media outlets actually reported on what they were doing.
Right.
Since nobody knows about what they're doing, it doesn't really add up.
Right.
And this is part of the war in Cuba, because Cuba does make money. So not all of the missions, but many of the missions. And that money goes back to Cuba that helps sustain their own free healthcare system. The doctors go on these missions voluntarily. They're actually eager to go on the missions because they get salaries that are much higher than what they earn in Cuba. And the missions now are being attacked left and right because the U.S. government knows this is a source of foreign currency for Cuba. And again, it's sort of part of the bigger plan of depriving Cuba of resources and essentially sort of trying to make Cuba become a failed state. Cuba's not a failed state. It hasn't been. But that's the objective.
Well, let me just ask you finally for thoughts for folks. And as I do understand, because the coverage of Cuba is kind of preserved in aspic, you know, and hasn't changed very much, there are folks who will be confused by the stories, by the media that they're reading. One story, this is from a couple of years ago, but still it tossed off a story about a blackout in Cuba as, well, Cuba is, quote, a communist country long accustomed to shortages of all kinds and spotty electrical service, close quote. So it's almost as if there's nothing to see here. The hardship and the suffering, there's nothing to see, and certainly nothing that you as a U.S. observer need to think about your own involvement in that situation. What do you say to folks as they are reading this news coming out of Cuba right now?
On the one hand, I feel like people are suffering. The situation is that it's getting worse, and you want to show that, right? Because the U.S. is causing it. And it's important to show not only that people are suffering, but major media outlets love to do that.
Right.
But, I mean, in our case, we like to show what is the cause. It's
yeah.
essential for people in the U.S. to know, okay, well, things are really bad in Cuba. Why? We have to do with it. We're the biggest reason that this situation is bad like this. On the other hand, you know, there's also this sort of like, I mean, I can't tell you the number of times I've seen this headline recently, Cuba's on the brink of collapse.
Right, right.
It's again and again, on the brink, about to collapse and so on. And then when I've seen Rubio interviewed by journalists, it's the same question. When is Cuba going to collapse? When is the government going to go down? When is this going to happen? Almost as if it's, you know, it's just this inevitable thing because now Trump has decided to do this and this is a good thing. It's just sort of implicit yeah. that this is a good thing and we just want to know when. Hopefully it's soon. That's sort of
right.
the context behind it. And we'll see. Nobody knows, right? It's the future. You can't predict it. But I'll tell you, Like, I just spoke with someone, I'm not in Cuba at the moment, I just spoke with someone who was visiting, and she said, her first reaction was like, this is not on the brink of collapse. I didn't mention those words, she did. She said, this is not at all what I've been hearing in the media. Things are bad. They're going to get worse. She's not denying that. But Cubans have had a long time dealing with sanctions. They've found ways to become self-sufficient. They are very used to rationing, and they're trying to hold out and maintain their sovereignty. And frankly, that's one thing as well. There's a long list of them, which I think is really an important word, sovereignty, mm-hmm. because our whole international system is based on the principle of sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And yet, again, in the way the U.S. views Cuba and has acted toward Cuba and major media outlets have, it's almost taken for granted that Cuba's sovereignty has no value, that it doesn't matter. I feel like that's one thing that I've come to appreciate as spending time in Cuba and reporting in Cuba, is that they're fiercely proud of their sovereignty. It's one line they're not going to cross. Right. And I think that's a good thing.
Yep.
I think that's a good thing when countries are sovereign. And I think it's a good thing when sovereignty is respected. So we'll see what happens. I think that the best thing people in the U.S. can do who are following Cuba is to speak out and say something about our policy there, because it's our government, with our resources, that is essentially playing a huge role in causing suffering in Cuba.
All right, then. Thank you so much. I'll end on that note. We've been speaking with journalist and filmmaker Reed Lindsay. You can read his recent piece with Amber Gagarin at Jacobin.com on collective punishment in Cuba. Reed Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Zimmer.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find decades of shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to show much needed support for Counterspin if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Michael Cherry. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Trump and congressional Republicans are pushing for changes to the electoral process that would make it harder for millions of people to vote. And some media are still presenting it as a matter of election integrity. Voter advocates described things like the Save America Act as aiming to make the U.S. into a show-us-your-papers dystopia. That bill likely won't make it out of the Senate, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be sounding the alarm loudly about the various multi-level efforts this White House is pursuing to take control of elections away from the people. We'll hear that worrisome and enraging story from Ari Berman, national voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, among other titles. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at some recent press. The United States has no right to wage war on Iran or to have a say who governs the country. You wouldn't get that baseline understanding, though, from this country's top opinion pages. As Gregory Shupak describes for FAIR.org, the Washington Post and New York Times are putting out arguments for the U.S. to escalate attacks on Iran out of, they're telling readers, a sincere desire to improve Iranians' lives and brighten their futures. The Post offered two editorials addressing the possibility of the U.S. undertaking a bombing and shooting war on Iran, with no opposition to that idea, as long as we...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that